the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
KQED traffic at 8:59 starts with a problem at the Bay Bridge. Good evening, Michael Bennett.
Good evening, Michelle. Westbound 80, the upper deck, as you head into the city, right around Treasure Island. Heads up, there is a stalled semi, and that's blocking the third lane from the left bridge. Crews hustling to get that moved. Walnut Creek, solo vehicle crash there, eastbound 24, right at 680, and that is blocking the left-hand lane. I'm Michael Bennett for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from the California Academy of Sciences. From redwood forests to deserts, breathtaking coasts to bustling cities, visitors can be inspired at California State of Nature. It's a new exhibit. Take tickets at calacademy.org. You're listening to member-supported KQED 88.5 San Francisco and KQEI 89.3 North Highland Sacramento. We are streaming live online at kqed.org, and the time is 9 p.m.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Leslie McClurg in for Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, three of the greatest all-time jazz legends, Duke, Satchmo, and the Count. Their respective nicknames for Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie. They are the lively stars in Larry Tye's new book, Jazzmen. We'll discuss how these talented men rose from humble beginnings to shocking heights during the early to mid-1900s. And we'll learn how the widespread appeal of their music helped pave the way for the civil rights movement and beyond. That's next after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Shea Stevens. Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador says he will cooperate with President Biden's new immigration policy that drastically limits asylum processing at the U.S.-Mexico border. NPR's Emily Green has more from Mexico City.
López Obrador says he spoke with Biden on Tuesday, shortly after the new restrictions on asylum cases at the southern border were announced. López Obrador says he asked Biden to deport migrants back to their home countries instead of sending them to Mexico, and also to address the root causes of migration. Under Biden's executive order, a large portion of migrants trying to reach the U.S. would have to remain in Mexico. Tens of thousands of non-Mexican citizens are currently turned away at the border each month. For NPR News, I'm Emily Green in Mexico City.
The United States is preparing to send $90 million to Gaza to aid Palestinians. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, estimates that roughly half the population in Gaza is facing severe food shortages. USAID Administrator Samantha Power says getting aid to civilians in the territory is still a challenge.
What the president has laid out is something that would pause the fighting. It would address some of these concerns that aid workers have about moving around, not just their safety, but the delays and the blockages at checkpoints and so forth. You know, all of that presumably would melt away and we would be able to flood the zone with the kinds of food and shelter that are needed. And as President Biden has said, pave the way for a permanent end of hostilities, because this just can't go on.
Power says up to 300 trucks are arriving at a large Palestinian encampment each day, but that it's still not enough. Police arrested more than a dozen people at Stanford University Wednesday after a group of pro-Palestinian protesters barricaded themselves inside of the university president's office. School officials say that the arrested students will be suspended and barred from graduation if they are also seniors. The channel into the Port of Baltimore is set to reopen this weekend. The port was closed over 2 months ago after the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. From member station WYPR, Scott Massioni has this update.
This week, crews removed the last part of the Francis Scott Key Bridge, blocking the 700-foot channel into the Port of Baltimore. Officials say the channel will reopen to ship traffic this weekend, restarting shipments that had been rerouted for the last 10 weeks to other ports across the nation. Baltimore's port brought in a large amount of the nation's auto parts, sugar, and farming equipment, but was closed to ship traffic after a cargo ship rammed into the Key Bridge in late March, causing its collapse. The incident killed six construction workers who were on the bridge at the time. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni in Baltimore.
When Wall Street stocks closed higher, the Dow gained 96 points. The Nasdaq jumped 330. This is NPR News. The CDC says dozens of people have been sick in at least two dozen states after consuming contaminated cucumbers. Testing is underway to determine if those patients were sickened by a strain of salmonella that was found during testing by a Florida producer last week. Fresh Start Produce says that a recall that it issued does not include cucumbers that are sold in grocery stores. Elon Musk says his company, SpaceX, is ready for another test flight of its giant rocket known as Starship. As NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports, this will be the fourth test.
Starship is the largest rocket ever built. To get off the ground requires 33 engines firing in perfect synchrony. SpaceX has been making steady progress in flight testing, although Starship has yet to successfully return to Earth. It broke apart during its last flight as it re-entered the atmosphere. This time, the company hopes to send the stainless steel spacecraft briefly into orbit. It'll attempt to glide through space partway around the world before landing in the Indian Ocean. This flight will not have any humans on board, but Starship may one day carry astronauts. NASA would like to use it to land people on the moon, and Musk himself has said that he hopes it will carry the first settlers to Mars. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Months after ending their legal dispute, the Walt Disney Company and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis are working together. An oversight board appointed by DeSantis has signed off on an agreement to invest billions of dollars to expand the entertainment giant's Florida resort and possibly open a new one. A final vote is set for next week. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, they'll publish family memories into a bound book to keep forever. Learn more at StoryWorth.com.
This week on the Right Nowish podcast, Miguel Bounce Perez's culture flows through his ink. Right Nowish talks with the artist about how childhood memories influence his murals and tattoos. Hear that conversation wherever you get your podcasts. The heat wave peaked today. It'll be a couple of degrees cooler tomorrow, followed by further cooling on Friday. The forecast high for San Francisco Thursday is 69. Sacramento should reach a high of 100 degrees tomorrow.
This is Forum. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm in today for Mina Kim. In the early and mid-1900s, three of the country's most legendary jazz musicians, Louis Armstrong, Count Basie, and Duke Ellington. These three men felled clubs with uplifting lyrics, rip-roaring harmonies, and beats that inspired dancing till sunrise. But these three musicians did a lot more than just entertain in nightclubs. They also transformed race in America, according to author Larry Tye. His new book is The Jazz Men. We will explore how these men defied racial boundaries on numerous fronts. Larry Tye is a former journalist for the Boston Globe and the author of numerous biographies. Welcome, Larry. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Great to be on with you.
So, Larry, the seed for this book came from some of your former reporting or one of your other books about the Pullman Porters. So who were those guys and how did they ignite this current work?
So the Pullman Porters were black men who worked on the railroad starting at the end of the Civil War and for 100 years after that. It was the best job a black man could get in America. And when I interviewed those porters 20 years ago, they made me promise that someday I would write another book about their three favorite passengers, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie. And the reason they were their favorite passengers, I think says a lot about the musicians, about the porters, and about America in that Jim Crow era of segregation. When these musicians, even though they were the most celebrated musicians in the world, when they would go below the Mason-Dixon line, going to the wrong restaurant and trying to get a meal, going to the wrong hotel and trying to book a room, could lead to their being berated, beaten, or even at the end of a hangman's noose. And so what they did when they went south was, when they could afford it, which was for a long time, they would go rent a private Pullman sleeping car. And if they were doing a concert in a place like Atlanta, they would do their performance, and afterwards they knew that they could go back to their sidetracked sleeping car for a great meal, for a plush bed, and for safety. And in return, in the middle of the night, in the closed capsule of this railroad car, they would give a private jam session for the porters. And I don't know about you, Leslie, but if I could go back to any moment in history, getting a private concert from the Duke Ellington Band in a railroad car would be a pretty nice place to be.
I have chills just imagining being inside those cars back then. I mean, given the picture that you just painted there, you know, nooses and, fearing for their lives, basically, at this time, who were their audiences? Who were listening to them play in the South? I mean, it was both blacks and whites. And how did they sort of make sense of that?
So it was blacks and whites, and it was nonsensical. The idea that on the one hand, they could be performing for these groups. In one case, Count Basie got 10 standing ovations. And when he went outside the concert hall, a white guy threw him his keys and said, "Get me my car," thinking he had to be the valet. Duke Ellington, when he performed in Virginia and he didn't have a private sleeping car to go back to, his manager talked the owner of a segregated whites-only hotel to let him stay there. But the hotel manager explained that they would have to pay an extra fee for the pillowcases and sheets, because of course they would have to burn them after a black man had slept in them. The logic of what was happening to them in terms of the indignities they had to suffer when they were playing in front of enormous white audiences, it just made no sense.
And where were the blacks in these audiences? Were they also, you know, on the sidelines?
So the blacks in the audiences were non-existent for a long time. The audiences, especially when they went south, but even in the north, were often segregated. But as early as 1945, Count Basie wrote into his contracts that he wouldn't play if the audiences were segregated. They were sometimes separated by ropes, sometimes just no blacks allowed at all. Later on, Ellington and Armstrong made the same conditions. They helped ensure that audiences would be integrated, but the natural tendency in that era of Jim Crow was to either ban blacks or banish them to the balcony.
And so were those early requests to integrate black audiences the beginnings of how they planted or how they influenced the civil rights movement?
So they were one of many ways. And I want to just describe to you what I think was going on in a more quiet kind of insurrection that these guys planted. I think that white men who would never have let a black man across their threshold wooed their sweethearts to the music of the gravel-throated Louis Armstrong and to the Ellington Band. White women who, if they saw a black man come towards them on the street, would have walked to the other side of the street in the privacy of their own living rooms, kicked off their high heels and tapped their toes to the music of the Count Basie Orchestra. Race, when these three were playing, for once fell away as America listened, rapt.
Did they use their music to change the minds and the hearts? Did they insert their thoughts and their hopes and sort of sing about how hard things were for them?
So they did precisely that. Duke Ellington insisted over the years that jazz should be renamed Negro music. And that was because he used his music. He composed more than 6,000 songs, and his compositions told the story of Black America in very explicit terms. Louis Armstrong did the same thing, as did Count Basie, and they said, "We want our music to speak for itself," and the magnificence of their music, I think, is precisely what opened America's ears and souls to the notion of Black genius and of Blacks deserving equal rights. But at some points, they actually went beyond that. They said, "We want our music to speak for itself," and yet they spoke up in ways that were unheard of back then.
And this was acknowledged by Martin Luther King Jr. in a speech, a 1964 speech. He called jazz music triumphant, and he simultaneously acknowledged, you know, how jazz was really a driving force in the freedom movement. How else was jazz acknowledged, and was it acknowledged, you know, beyond just Black activists, but even among whites?
So it was acknowledged as being the all-American music form, and that whole era in the 20s and 30s was known as the jazz age, because jazz was the coolest movement, the coolest music out there. The same way in my generation it was rock and roll, and today it may be hip-hop or all kinds of other music forms. Back then, jazz was it. Whites who could afford to would go to fancy jazz clubs in places like Harlem or in the Loop in Chicago. It was the kind of music that was making a statement that you believed in change and you believed in improvisation, and eventually you believed in ideally equal rights for Blacks and whites.
All three of these men had careers that were incredibly long, more than 50 years. What else knitted them together? They were obviously incredibly talented, but were there other similarities between these three musical legends?
They were. They were all born within 5 years of one another at the turn of the 20th century, and they all had this passion for doing something beyond their music. This is, we all know, we didn't need the 1,001st book talking about what they did musically. We all know about their musical legacy and their musical genius. But what they all shared was a sense that they could use their celebrity to make a statement beyond the music world. And just to give you an example of what Louis Armstrong did, back in 1957, the biggest confrontation racially in America was over integrating Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, the Little Rock Nine, very famous case. The governor of Arkansas, a racist governor named Orville Faubus, said, Blacks will essentially come into this school over my dead body. And President Eisenhower did nothing to protect those nine kids who are trying to integrate the high school. Most white leaders and most Black leaders were too afraid to speak up and say much. Louis Armstrong had a young reporter come to his hotel suite expecting a standard story, just a few quotes. Instead, Armstrong told him in very explicit terms what he thought about what the governor was doing. And he used a word that began with M and that ended with R and wouldn't make it beyond the radio censors, and that was watered down in when it finally made it to print, calling him an uneducated plowboy. He called our president, our war hero president, Dwight Eisenhower, gutless. And I don't think it's any accident that shortly after he did that, and after this made headlines across America and around the world, President Eisenhower sent in federal troops to protect those kids who were integrating the schools. And one after another, these three decided that just letting your music speak for itself wasn't enough, and they went to the front lines, they manned the barricades, and they helped tear down Jim Crow.
And that's an even more impressive story, because we're going to hear about the humble beginnings that all three of these men had just after this break. We're talking with Larry Tye. He's a journalist and author. He's just written The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. We'd love to hear from you, our audience. Did you listen to these musicians growing up? Do you remember what it was like inside your household? Do you have a favorite among these three? Did they impact you? Did their music impact you? Tell us your story, your experience. We'd love to hear it. You can email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org or pick up the phone. Give us a call right now at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Coming up at 10 o'clock tonight on Kelly Corrigan Wonders, a conversation about spirituality and well-being. Kelly Corrigan talks with Alexis Abernathy, a devoted scientist and daughter of a preacher. Abernathy studies patience, comfort, and strain in the context of cancer, disordered eating, and depression. Hear more tonight at 10 and again at 1 tomorrow morning on KQED Public Radio. Swipe, tap, informed. KQED's social media channels are your go-to for the latest news updates. The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51, AFL-CIO. The Forum rebroadcast continues at 9:20. This is KQED.
Hello, Dolly. This is Louis. Dolly, it's so nice to have you back where you belong. You looking swell, Dolly. I can tell, Dolly. You still growing, you still growing, you still going strong.
Louis Armstrong. We're talking about the three jazz legends, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and Count Basie. We're talking about their lives with Larry Tai. He's a journalist and author of the new book, The Jazzmen, How These Three Transformed America. We just heard there, Larry, Hello Dolly, obviously, by Louis Armstrong. Tell us about that song.
That was Louis's signature song late in his life. Generally, what happens when a song is associated with a musical, the musical becomes famous and then the songs are recorded and are sold and maybe become famous tagging along with the musical. In this case, Louis Armstrong's rendition of Hello Dolly was so inspired that it made the musical a success in a way that they had never dreamed it would be. He eventually sold 3 million records with Hello Dolly. And imagine this, at age 63, he knocked the Beatles off of their number one spot on the Billboard charts.
Wow. And again, this is so impressive to me because you start your book with Louis Armstrong's very, very humble beginnings in a really rough neighborhood called the Battlefield in New Orleans. So tell us about his childhood and how he found his way to the trumpet.
So as you say, he grew up in a neighborhood so tough that they called it the Battlefield. But I think his musical career was launched and his life was saved when at age 13, he was plucked off the streets and sent to reform school. And so many of his friends, as he recounted, never made it beyond 13 that he felt that it saved his life. Reform school, the 18 months he spent there is where he learned how to play the bugle, then the cornet, then the trumpet that we all know hit high notes that nobody before him or since has even dreamed of hitting. So he was essentially launched by surviving his really difficult beginnings. He also was raised by a single mother who had to go out and work the streets to earn a living, and it all made him understand Jim Crow, understand what it meant to try to survive and to make a basic living and to be appreciative of everything that came to him with all the successes he had. It was by the time he was in his 40s and 50s, it was said that the two most recognizable American cultural figures around the world were Mickey Mouse and Louis Armstrong. Duke Ellington...
You're good. You're good. I think what I just want to, the reason I want to interrupt is it sounds like we have a caller with a good story about Louis Armstrong. So Arlene in San Francisco, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, Arlene, my My great grandmother was the my great uncle Nick was with Louis Armstrong when he got picked off the streets. They were throwing rocks at an abandoned building, breaking the windows, and they got arrested. They both went to the home. My grandmother went and tried to get them both, but Louis's mother was a prostitute, and she wouldn't go get him. So he stayed, but my Uncle Nick got out. And then my grandmother was the one who, or my great-grandmother was the one who paid for the horns for him while he was there. Because you could do that stuff, but somebody had to finance the horns. And then he got out, and he was going to go on tour with my great-aunt Melissa, but they said that wasn't the life for a woman to do it, so she didn't go. And like you said, the Uncle Nick ended up drinking himself to death and didn't live past 30.
Oh.
But he straightened up because he was at the boys' home and learned to play the instrument and went out. And then he left New Orleans because he didn't want to be there with those statues. He tried to get them to take those Confederate statues down, and they wouldn't, so he said, I'm out of here. And then later my cousin, he was like down in New Orleans, I'm like having trouble saying all the names. I had a little head injury, so names come hard for me. But he was given all of their stuff for Louis to create a museum. But then Katrina happened, and they didn't happen. And then he got cancer, and he passed. So now it's like in limbo, but there's still supposed to be a museum in the Garden District for Louis that's still in the works.
Wow. Arlene, thank you so much for sharing that personal history. I really appreciate the call. Larry, when did and how did Louis Armstrong, kind of make his big break? So it's one thing to go and learn and be on street corners, you know, playing your bugle or your trumpet. It's another thing to be playing in front of, you know, thousands of people and on the radio all across the country.
First of all, I just want to say that story from Arlene is wonderful. There were actually two arrests, and she was describing one that happened earlier that the world never paid any attention to. And I love her family story, and I wish I had talked to her before I wrote my book. What happened to Louis Armstrong is he made his way out of New Orleans to Chicago. He was brought there by the great King Oliver, another great jazz star of that era. And the story that you're talking about is that he was launched to his true greatness in a tiny recording studio that was a portable studio in the middle of the loop with no room, no acoustics. He made, with a group called the Hut Fives, what stand today is probably the greatest jazz recording ever. And that catapulted him from a sort of sideman with King Oliver into a star in his own right. And he basically never looked back. He never also gave up top billing after that.
And what was he like on stage?
So on stage, he was willing to ham it up in a way that he knew would make audiences, and especially white audiences, comfortable. But he never saw it as a contradiction, being an entertainer and being an artist. And I want to say, back in that era in Chicago, he wasn't just playing the trumpet. He pioneered the putting down the trumpet and raising his voice, and he had the most unlikely raspy voice to become the most recognizable voice in jazz. And kids back then would, in the middle of winter, roll down the windows of their car and stick their head out of the car in hopes that they could catch cold and sound like Louis Armstrong.
Well, now we're going to hear a little from Duke Ellington. This is Take the Train. Again, that was Take the A Train from Duke Ellington. Tell us about that song, Larry.
So that was a song. Duke Ellington had met this young kid in Pittsburgh named Billy Strayhorn, and he told Billy that he seemed to be talented, and when he got out of high school, he he should give Ellington a call. He did that probably 2 seconds after he graduated, and Ellington said, come and talk to me. I want to interview you and maybe hire you for my band. And he gave Billy directions on how to get to him in Harlem, which included taking the A train. Strayhorn decided that the way to truly impress the great Duke Ellington was to convert those directions into a song, the Take the A Train song that you were just playing, that became Ellington's signature song. The good news was Strayhorn got the job. The bad news was 2 out of 3 times when the Ellington Orchestra played that song, Ellington conveniently forgot to mention that it was Billy Strayhorn's song and not his.
We're talking about Louis Armstrong. Right there, we're talking about Duke Ellington and Count Basie with Larry Tai. He's the author of the new book, The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. We'd love to hear from you. Did you listen to these musicians growing up? What was it like? How did it land in your family? Did it change anything for your family to hear this music? Maybe you have some questions for Tai about these three musicians. Email your comments or questions to forum@kqed.org, or you can find us on our social channels at KQED Forum. You can give us a call right now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. So Larry, how did Duke Ellington find his way from Washington, D.C., where he grew up, to, you know, sort of his legendary heights?
So when he was growing up in Washington, he lived in a middle-class home and didn't have all the challenges that Louis Armstrong had had. And every morning when he would walk down the big staircase in his house, he would tell his young nephews who were waiting at the bottom to bow to him. He would tell his young nieces to curtsy, and he would tell everybody, applaud, applaud, because someday the world is going to know me as the great and the grand Duke Ellington. And over the years, Ellington told a dozen stories on where his nickname came from. But the truth is, he dubbed himself Duke. And the truth is that he was worthy of that aristocratic title. He played successfully in Washington. He found his way to New York. And he got launched at a club called the Cotton Club, which was the club in Harlem. The good news was that the Cotton Club had a radio hookup that took him across the country. The bad news was that it was set up in a plantation motif, and the owners, the mobsters who owned the Cotton Club, referred to Ellington and his band as playing jungle music.
I have to admit, that's another, I wouldn't mind being a fly on the wall in that scene, a plantation set up with one of the greatest jazz musicians of all time. That is hard to imagine in this era. Kind of paint a picture. What was Duke like on the stage? I mean, clearly he was performing from the time he really popped out. But what kind of performer was he, and where did his real skills shine?
So he was an elegant performer. He was a bit of an elitist in terms of whereas Louis Armstrong was a guy who loved to show his heart in everything he did. Ellington was a guy who showed more his head. He was a brilliant composer, a brilliant arranger, a brilliant piano player, but did it all with a subtlety, which is something that Armstrong thought was not quite reaching audiences. They each had a different way of connecting with audiences, one through the heart, one through the head.
Let's hear from another caller here. Barbara in Half Moon Bay, you're on the air.
Oops. Sorry.
You're live, Barbara. Oh. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I thought you had recorded what I had told you. I was talking to Leslie about how my grandmother, who lived in Fremont until about 104 years, she was 104 years old, and I spent afternoons with her every week as she was aging, and she told me her stories, and one of them was how her first date with my grandfather, he took her to a nightclub, and she said there was a young man, young musician named Duke Ellington that was playing. And he played that song, Solitude. And it's not one that I'd ever heard before, but I did pull it up on. really loud, and she put her ear up against my phone and listened, and she said, that's the one.
Oh, that's such a beautiful story, Barbara. Thank you so much for sharing that. You're cutting in and out, but I think we got the hint of your story, which is such a beautiful moment to capture. Before we go into the break, I want to hear a little bit about Count Basie. First, we're going to start with the song "Fly Me to the Moon." That song has our engineer dancing in the control room. That's "Fly Me to the Moon" by Count Basie. Larry, tell me about that song.
Sure. That was a song that Count Basie performed as his signature song towards the end of his career. And that song actually made its way to the moon. The Apollo astronauts loved it almost as much as your engineer does. And they took it to the moon with them on a tape recorder. And in those days, astronauts had this perpetual dialogue with Cape Canaveral, and the Cape wanted to know what they were listening to. They talked about "Fly Me to the Moon," and the song became a sensation. But they used to say that if you listened to Count Basie and his band and your toes weren't tapping, that there must be something anatomically wrong with you and you ought to go see a doctor. He had a way of, his music was known as Kansas City swing music, because that's where he developed it. And he had a way of getting people up dancing in a way that even exceeded what Ellington and Armstrong could do.
I feel like we're all tapping here in the studio. Let's hear from another caller, DG in Oakland. You're on the air.
Hi there. While I was in college, I would take one of our neighbors. His name was Father Hines, Earl Father Hines. And he asked me to drive him to the Fairmont, at which time we went to the concierge desk. We got the room number, went up to the room. He banged on the door very hard. When the man answered, it was Count Basie. You would have thought those two were 18 years old again. They talked about all kinds of things. Downstairs in the Venetian room, they were playing. Count Basie and his orchestra were performing, and I had dinner with him. I don't know if your host can explain who Earl Father Hines is, but that was my story. At the end of the concert, they had a big, huge frame. In that frame says, "Now appearing Count Basie and his orchestra." The hotel sent me the poster weeks later. That's my story.
I bet you remember that afternoon or evening really well. Thank you so much for calling in, DG. Do you know Father Hines, Larry?
Yes. So Earl Hines was one of the great jazz musicians of that era. And I got to say, Leslie, you have a way of bringing out readers who have these magnificent stories. And I'm jealous of all of your listeners who are calling in. The idea of being there with Earl Hines and the idea of having dinner with Count Basie. Wow.
We have about a minute before we go into the break, but quickly, Larry, since we talked about our other two, where did Count Basie grow up and what was his childhood like?
So he grew up in Red Bank, New Jersey, an hour outside of New York. His childhood was one of trying to find a way to get the heck out of Red Bank. He initially thought about joining the circus. He ended up realizing that his piano playing was the quickest way to get out of Red Bank. He went to New York, learned at the feet of Fats Waller, and only went back to Red Bank when he had to.
We're talking about Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and their Count Basie, and we're joined by Larry Tai. He's the journalist and author of a new book, The Jazzmen, How These Three Transformed America. We want to hear from you. Did you have the opportunity to see any of these musicians? We've already heard from listeners who did, and that's just incredible. So give us a call or write in your email, your comments, questions to forum@kqed.org, or you can give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. 733-6786. Maybe one of these musicians is your favorite. Tell us why. Or maybe you grew up during this time, during the civil rights movement, and there were other art forms that may have influenced you or influenced your view on race. We'd love to hear those stories as well. Again, give us a call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Coming up tomorrow on Forum, Ruth Whitman is a feminist writer. She's also the mother of three sons. Her new book, Boy Mom, asks how to raise good men in an age where people on the right weaponize male concerns and people on the left dismiss them. Whitman says that to meaningfully address the growing loneliness in young American men, we need to reconsider how we raise all of our children. We'll hear about her reporting and her own experiences as a boy mom. To listen to past Forum shows, go to Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search KQED Forum.
Take me down to Duke's place. Wildest box in town is Duke's place. Love that piano sound in Duke's place. Saxes do their tricks in Duke's place.
God, I would love to be there and hear that live. So amazing. That's Duke's Place by Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington. That was a collaborative that they did together for Roulette Records. Larry, were they frequently collaborating? Did these three, you know, creatively collaborate on a regular basis?
Infrequently collaborated. When they did, they were brilliant. But I think that they didn't get together much. While they said terrific things and lauded one another all the time, their actions spoke much louder. And I think it was because they all had substantial egos. And if you were Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington got on the stage with you, you had to share the spotlight. And that's something none of them liked to do.
All three of these men traveled internationally. How did the rest of the world receive them? And did they change race in that conversation in other places?
Yes. So they did all travel internationally, sometimes on their own. And in the late 1950s and early 1960s, they were actually sponsored by the State Department. That was an era when we were in a superheated Cold War with the Soviet Union. And one of the arguments the Soviets used against America in trying to sign up unaligned nations with them was that America was a racist place. And one of America's responses was to send its three best jazz ambassadors around the world, including behind the Iron Curtain. And when they got overseas, while they were critical of America's Jim Crow segregation policies in America, when they got overseas, they became uber patriots. And when reporters asked them, what about racism back home? They would say, yes, we have problems, and yes, we are fixing them. They believed in America. The truth is that, in fact, all three of them got such good receptions when they first went overseas, and especially in Europe, that they had toyed with the idea of staying there, but they ended up realizing their roots were here. They came back. They tolerated the indignities because they were trying to change the indignities.
Obviously, these were incredible personalities who did incredible things for the country, but as a woman, I can't help but note that these are three men. Why didn't you include a woman in your lineup?
So great question. And the answer is I looked hard and I anticipated that question, and I included a chapter on side men and another chapter on side women. But the sad truth is that back in this era, starting in the 1930s and going all the way through the 60s, for women to be anything other than vocalists, which was important but was a sidelight role, was almost impossible. Great female instrumentalists had a really tough time breaking through. Great female band leaders had an even harder time. So if you were a Black woman, you had this double stigma. And the stigmatization was even by our three great jazzmen. They and everybody else referred to the women vocalists as canaries and thrushes, and they didn't quite see that the gender bias was not a whole lot different than the racial bias that they suffered. There was one woman who broke through, and that was a woman who your listeners may not recognize if I said her name was Lillian Harden, but if I added her third name, it was Lillian Harden Armstrong, Louis Armstrong's second wife, who helped him break out of his sideman status and become a true star, who played the piano with him on the Hut 5 recordings we discussed earlier, and who went on to become a composer, an arranger, a terrific piano player, and a band leader.
There's your next book, Larry. Let's go to Alicia in Berkeley. Alicia, you're on the air.
In the show, what a great book. I have a story about my mother meeting Duke Ellington on a plane ride once. She was a simple housewife of that big band era and loved Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby. That kind of music was all she was much exposed to. And she was going on a trip to, or going to meet my dad. He always used to take her out a couple times a year because we had eight kids and she worked her fingers to the bone to raise us. So my lovely father would take her away at least twice a year to just have a rest and rejuvenation. So anyway, she's on the plane with Duke Ellington, and he, what surprised me was how he was so much more interested in her life than he was in talking about his own. And so his big question to her was, how do you get away with all those kids? How do you ever get away to have a rest? And she said, Mr. Ellington, the moment that cabin door closes, I'm not a mother, I'm not a wife, I don't have eight kids, I'm just out here to have a good time.
Oh, Alicia, that's a great story. That's a really great story.
I love it. And we used to always tease her about the day she flirted with Duke Ellington. But she came home and all of a sudden got real interested in jazz, and I had to go out and get her some of his records, so it was pretty good.
Beautiful. We have another caller. It sounds like Amy in San Leandro. You have another Duke tale.
Yes, I do. When I was about 17, a senior at Berkeley High, Duke Ellington was visiting the Berkeley High campus, and it was commemorating the desegregation movement that was happening in Berkeley. And my best friend Abby and I both received a kiss on the cheek from Duke Ellington that day. It was very exciting.
Who is our audience today? These stories are incredible. Amy, thank you so much. Did he leave, other than a kiss on the cheek, which is very memorable, any other lasting memories of that day or of his personality?
Well, it was very giving and generous, and he was pretty upbeat, but that also happened to be the day that we got asked on her first date, and it was probably the only date I ever had thereafter, but it wasn't from Duke Ellington.
Well, a good day indeed, Amy. Thank you so much for sharing that story. I would love to stay on that high note of these men's personalities, but they weren't always so gracious in terms of their fidelity. What were some of their not so loyal or admirable qualities, Larry?
Three of these guys were men of faith. They believed in God, they prayed before meals, and they read the Bible. And Duke Ellington said he actually read it cover to cover three times. But I could count at least five commandments that they broke regularly. And the one that you mentioned and the one that these stories elicit is that all of them had a very difficult time remaining faithful. Louis Armstrong was married four times. And even with his fourth wife, who stayed married to him for a full generation, he cheated on her, and she knew that. And the idea that she stayed with him, she loved him enough to excuse his infidelities, but there really was no excuse. Count Basie was married twice. He cheated enough on his wife that at least twice She left him, but ended up coming back. The only one of the three who stayed married to the same woman his entire life was Duke Ellington, only that marriage was only a real marriage for a couple years. And after they had a child, he fairly quickly disappeared. And the reason he stayed married was he had so many mistresses. He was out there, as though the last two callers suggested, flirting perpetually, and he had enough mistresses that he stayed married because it gave him the perfect excuse on why he didn't marry any of his mistresses. And his granddaughter took me on an amazing tour of Harlem. We visited all the places that he lived. We visited everywhere that he had played. But the longest part of the tour was we looked at every apartment building where he had stashed a mistress. And that took a long time.
Oh, my God. What an incredible tale. Larry, you always kind of weave a little bit or try to into your books, you know, sort of a Jewish connection. And you did in this book as well. So talk about the Black and Jewish alliance that was forming and very important during this time.
So each of these three maestros had a Jewish manager. Each one had Jewish bandmates and Jewish friends. The one who had the closest connection in the last century's famous Black-Jewish alliance was Louis Armstrong, who, when he was a kid on the streets of New Orleans, had a tough time making a living, and he ended up being hired by an Eastern European immigrant Jewish family named Karnofsky. And they had what was known as a shmati wagon, which was a rag wagon, and they drove it through the streets of New Orleans trying to sell their rags. The best way to attract attention, they realized, was to give Louis Armstrong a horn and have him play incredibly compelling tunes that drew attention to their rag wagon. In response, they took him home at night on many nights and fed him and sang him lullabies that he said helped form the basis of the music that he was composing. And he showed his love for this family for the rest of his life by wearing around his neck a Star of David and by entitling the third of his memoirs to the Jewish family from New Orleans. All three of them showed the basis for Blacks and Jews who were shared a love of telling stories and who were outsiders. They formed the kind of bond that I think someday could be a model for reforging the frayed alliance between Blacks and Jews today.
We're talking about Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and Count Basie with Larry Tai. He's a journalist and the author of the new book, The Jazzmen: How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm in today for Mina Kim, and you are listening to Forum. Let's go to another caller, Risa in Oakland. You are on the air.
Hi. My story is I was at Zellerbach Auditorium in Berkeley at a Duke Ellington concert, and at one point he said, "This next song is dedicated to the most beautiful woman here." And every woman in the place sat up straight, flipped her hair, and then he played basketball. It was great.
I missed, which song did he play? I mean, you cut out just a touch there, Risa.
Yeah, it was Satin Doll.
Ah, beautiful, beautiful. Thank you, Risa, for sharing that story. Let's go to Bruce in the Bronx.
Howdy. One of the most incredible events when I was in college, I lived on 111th Street between Amsterdam and Broadway, and at the end of the street is St. John the Divine, and that's where Duke Ellington's funeral was. And it was just an incredible event in the hood. I mean, that's an enormous cathedral, and the place was filled to the brim. And there are all of these illustrious people showing. It went on, geez, from I think 10 in the morning, just went on and on. And it was just an amazing event, which I have get a little emotional thinking about it, when all of the people from Joan Baez to all these other jazz people, I think Sinatra was there. And I would guess, I don't know when he passed away, but I would guess I was in college from 66 to 70. and maybe it was in graduate school there, and that was 71 or something. When did he pass away?
Larry?
Can I say one thing about that? We just celebrated, by the way, the 125th anniversary of Duke's birth and the 50th anniversary of his passing away, which was in 1974. But anybody who's visiting New York should think about visiting Woodlawn Cemetery. After he was interred at the St. John the Divine, he was buried in the Bronx at the Woodlawn Cemetery. And the wonderful thing about the Ellington plot is you can see his life playing out there. He was buried next to his favorite mistress. On the other side of him was his mother, who he adored. A couple people away was his father, who he adored a bit less. And across the street is the great Miles Davis. Up the hill is just about every jazz great from that era. And I'm convinced, Leslie, if you and I took a trip to Woodlawn at midnight, we would hear the most amazing jam session ever.
You have a date. I'm on. Let's do it. That sounds amazing. How did these three men, how did they pass? How did the end of their lives, how did they pass on?
So they passed at ages in their 70s that were older than most people were living back then. And the idea that they lived as unhealthy lives as they did, spending 300 days a year on the road, smoking, drinking, living lives that one would have thought would have curtailed them, the idea that they all passed away as late as they did and all performing until almost the last second is kind of extraordinary. It's also extraordinary to think, although Leslie, you will top this, that they each lasted not just in their profession, but at the top of their profession for a full half century.
I got a long way to go, Larry, but I appreciate that vote of confidence. You talked to 250 people for this book, and I noted many times that, you know, the stories were sometimes intersecting. It sounded like these three men liked their tall tales. The county records weren't exactly always accurate for these African-American men. What was the most challenging and the most helpful part of researching this book?
It was challenging given how little I knew about jazz starting out. And what was incredibly helpful, like every reporter, you begin the day knowing next to nothing about the story you're going to have to explain to readers or listeners by the end of the day. And it was amazing to me the patience of people, very busy musicians like Wynton Marsalis and John Batiste, busy politicians like Bill Clinton. People gave hours of time to me and helped me understand not just these guys' musical legacy, but what they did that the world hasn't appreciated in helping move the dial and write the soundtrack for the civil rights revolution.
A listener writes, "These three have inspired me my entire life. Raised in a hippie life by a single mom from abroad, I grew up listening to all three of these geniuses. As a teacher and mom, I have used their music to inspire, to teach, and celebrate Black history. So thankful for their magic, their music, and their leadership." Larry, a final comment from you. How did writing this book, or how did their lives, how has it changed you?
It made me understand that we don't get to social change in a straight line. 2 weeks ago, the world celebrated the 70th anniversary of Brown versus Board, arguably the most important civil rights and maybe any Supreme Court decision. And as Martin Luther King said, we never would have gotten to integrating our schools and our society if these jazz men hadn't been infiltrating those white households with their Black genius.
That's Larry Tye, journalist and author of the new book, The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. And he will be coming to San Francisco on July 17th at 6 p.m. He's speaking at the Mechanics Institute in San Francisco, and I highly recommend hearing him talk. Larry, it's been such a pleasure this morning. Thank you for your time.
It was a blast being on with you. Thank you, Leslie.
Have a great morning, everyone.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity